Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. My name's Dolta Doherty, and in this podcast series, I will be speaking to investors, advisors, entrepreneurs, and recruiters who are based all over the world, and we'll be discussing how you set up, operate, and scale a world-class recruitment company. Today, I'm going to bring you to Houston, and we're going to be speaking to Matt Evelt. He's a group president for Gattaca, a specialist engineering oil and gas recruitment firm. He's worked for Faircroft, TRS Staffing, and a few others over his 20-year career that has taken him from Houston to Mexico City to Abu Dhabi and back again. And this episode is really me delving into how things look for somebody who runs a major staffing firm, and to try and get their viewpoint on what he does as a president of a recruitment firm, and what's been his experience of setting up and developing and delivering on staffing services, which if you're in the UK, that means major contracts. So, great guest, really knowledgeable, really credible guy, and I hope you get something from this. I definitely did. Matt Evelt, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. I think I'd prefer to be in Texas today, though.
Is the weather rough where you are?
Yeah, man. Winters in the UK, break your heart, so it would.
Well, half of my region's in Toronto, so I feel the pain sometimes.
Oh, yeah. But you're living in Texas, are you?
I do. I live in Houston or an airport otherwise.
Oh, fantastic. So welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. Delighted to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
And why I wanted to get you on is because you're a well-traveled man. And I wanted to see things from an American's viewpoint of what it's like working for UK companies, what it's like to travel and set up offices around the world, and just basically go into some detail on what's changed throughout your 20-year career in our wonderful world of staffing, as you would call it.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful world. So definitely agree with you on that one. But I do have to ask a question first. Am I the first American on your podcast?
No. But you might be the first American that has worked for a number of UK companies. I had a guy called Adam Posner on the other day, and he worked for Gary Vee, and we talked about that. And I've had Million Dollar Biller Rich Rosen on. He's an independent recruiter. And we've had a few others. They usually fall into work either being coaches for recruiters or independent recruiters. I tend to find that America's a funny market. It's like there's big giant staffing firms, and then there seems to be a lot of independent recruiters as well, especially compared to Europe anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. If you see some of the reports that come out these days, 80% of all the businesses with two or three or four firms. However, we got, I think they said 2,000 different firms in the engineering market and even more in the IT market. So a lot of money sitting with a couple few of the big boys out there. So, so just with regards to your first question, I think, early on in my career, it was mostly spent with the big firm, one of the biggest. So I was lucky. I was fortunate to come into the recruitment world. I think when recruitment was still kind of, we call old school recruitment, I think everybody had, my first couple of weeks on the job, everybody still had the card catalog on the table. You still had people going through the phone books and dialing, calling dial in for dollars back in the day. And then over time, quickly, we got into more of the internet databases, and then that evolved into recruitment today, where it's no one picks up the phone as much anymore, which is very frustrating at points. But
it must be hard from a leadership perspective. But we will jump into that. Talk to me about those early days at AeroTech. What were you recruiting for?
I started with the best of the best, and that's learning, you know, general labor, light technical. In those days, it was mostly filling warehouses, you know, of all types of skill sets. So everything from assemblers, packers, forklift drivers. And it was right in between the days of, you know, really driving a bus and picking up your workforce and bringing them out to a site, to kind of the next level of actually picking people based off their skill and make sure they're a match for the company based off what they can do, but also their personality and kind of their long-term goals. So it was a good blend for me to understand high volume recruitment, learning the pitfalls of dealing with people as a product, and then also dealing with some of the big clients out there that, you know, employ thousands and thousands of people. So it was a really interesting start.
And was it mainly servicing the oil and gas contractors at the time?
Not out of the gate. Out of the gate, it was mostly production type companies. Everything from manufacturing to the healthcare, pharmaceutical industry. Just clients were all over the shop in the beginning. But it was just about getting bodies, one that could pass all the screen requirements, but then also that you know, were intended to stick out the project.
What kept you in that job for 5 years?
I think with Aerotech, you know, I really had a fantastic start to the business. It was very tough. You know, it's, you know, they pride themselves in screening out those that actually want to give it a go in the industry and want to give it everything they have. And those that don't, they go out pretty quick. But I got to learn absolutely everything about the business quickly. I learned recruitment, quickly moved my way into sales, quickly got pushed into more of sales management, large account management. That started my traveling within staffing. They sent me all over the U.S. Opening big accounts, managing those accounts, and making sure that we fulfilled our obligations. And I think it made me a pretty solid staffing professional by the time that those 5 years were up.
And for anybody who's listening, American staffing, it's quite different in a lot of ways to the way that the U.K. market works. A lot of U.K. recruiters are 360. So they're doing the candidates and the client piece, but you would have been flying around, opening up those accounts, and then sending those recs back to a pit of resourcers. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. I think the biggest, you know, after, you know, as you know, most of my experience is all over the world. But I think my biggest takeaway of the difference between especially the UK and the American market is the American market is very you know, face forward in front of the client. A lot of handshakes, a lot of lunches, a lot of really getting to know the ins and outs of their business in person. Whereas it seems, like you said, a lot of the UK market, which is actually a much more mature market, is that 360, calling in, getting the spec, having a fantastic candidate and getting a fee for it. Mm. Whereas a lot of the American staffing market is, it's not just about finding the candidate. It's about making sure that they not only go to the job, stay on the job, but perform at a certain level, that you keep pipelines moving forward so that the client doesn't miss out on somebody working in the environment.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, I could be speaking out of turn, but I always think that the American businesses are better at contract and the UK businesses are better at perm. And
yeah, I would say, when you say better, I would say it's just, it's more involved. You know, a lot of the UK contract business came from, you know, for example, an engineer would be working on site. He has buddies that could also come in on a contract, and that was their contract business. Whereas a lot of the American market is going out, you have to win an agreement. You have to gain the trust of the client. And then the journey ahead is to not only, like I said, find talent, just to make sure that they stay on that project. So I think although the UK is a more mature contract market, I think sometimes the US can be a more complex contract market.
Yeah, and a lot of UK recruitment companies have done very well historically in Houston. Your NES and Brunel and S3 and Spencer Ogden. There's quite a few, isn't there?
Yeah, there was a big wave for about 10 years there during the oil and gas boom. And I think it was just as we all think, and that's, if you have a great product in one country, it should, replicate well in one of the largest growing markets in the world. And now I would say one of the is the largest market in the world. I would say that some of the downfalls are understanding that local presence needed as far as that relationship style selling in the US. That's quite different in the UK, and that's where some maybe have found issues of really getting success that they planned on. But those that got it right, I mean, they're doing really well, have big numbers, especially in Houston. I think the recent downfall in oil and gas hurt quite a bit. Some have either felt the pain and stuck it out, or some have kind of abandoned the market. But now that things are going back on track, quite a bit are back in the market.
Yeah, I've lived in two oil and gas towns myself. I lived in Perth in Australia whenever the boom was happening there,
Absolutely.
and then we moved to Calgary to try and catch the boom in 2015, and we know what happened then.
I think that's always the interesting part, is by the time you hear of a boom and if you're not already in location, by the time you get set up and getting people in place, you almost find that you've missed the boom and you've overspent. So a lot of the challenge, I think, is understanding markets on the long term to where you should be investing and putting people. So those that are chasing that boom, unless it's from a perm standpoint where you can make quick deals, get your money and get out. I think it's really risky unless you really, really know where you want to be in the long run.
When was your first international move?
I opened Mexico City for a company that I was working for in the US. And predominantly was to support our internal client because they needed a contract solution in one of the toughest markets, I would say, to have that solution. But it took a lot of time to figure out how we could do it both legally but also to make a profit. We were able to do that. But going back to the original point, we had a reason and a long-term reason to be in Mexico City, so it made sense. Whereas if we would have just said, how we think we can make some money in Mexico City, I don't think we would have made it and lasted the time it took to get up and going.
What
And that operation is still going today.
was that like setting up that office? Do you speak Spanish?
I speak enough Spanish at the time. I've gotten a lot better over the years because I've spent a lot more time. But I think the difficulty was it just wasn't a mature market outside of headhunting. And that was, contract staffing, to say, in Mexico City was, it's a really tough thing to do. The labor market in Mexico in general, and most Latin American countries, as you find out, is a very pro-labor workforce. So they have a ton of laws to protect, the labor force, and rightfully so, because obviously they've been through some hard times over the past, decades. And so when you're trying to implement a temporary or flexible workforce into a society that's more long-term security type workforce, it's just really difficult. It takes a lot of lawyers to get involved. It takes a lot of HR professionals to really understand not only how the law works, but how are you not only going to sell it to the potential contractors to even accept that environment. But what we found is once we figured it out, it was actually really attractive in a time when actually the market was pretty flat, relatively flat in Mexico City. But there was a lot of people that were, once you could explain it to them, could see the benefit of it. And now it's booming. Everyone's using contractors, and a lot of international companies have moved into Mexico City over the past 10 years and are fully taking advantage of what they take advantage elsewhere in the world.
And what was it like from an internal staffing perspective for you? Did you get somebody local on the ground? Were you able to bring people down from the States? What was the challenges of putting an American-based work culture into a Latin-based city?
Yeah, I think two big focus points were there was a lot of talent, recruitment of talent available, but like I said, from a headhunter's standpoint, so they're really good at recruiting and matching job skills to job requisitions. But they didn't understand kind of the project recruitment world and how you not only find people for jobs, but you plan out a project to make sure that you fulfill kind of the client's needs. So we had to do quite a bit of work, and what we did is we involved the client in those searches. So we were doing the first stage of interviews for our first, 5-10 people on the ground. We actually had the client get involved with those interviews to really get them to understand what that work life cycle would look like, and it helped quite a bit screen out some of those that probably weren't up for the task or maybe not the right fit. And at the end of the day, we just really got lucky with finding people that can not only understand recruitment but understand potentially a new market, and that's that contract staffing side.
And you were down there during the recession. Did you manage to kind of skip the recession as such by being there, or did you still feel the pains of it?
Well, the interesting thing about Mexico City and why I think those that have a long-term plan there, it actually does work out real well, both on engineering and the technology side. Whereas when the U.S. goes into recession, a lot of money is spent in Mexico because they're still catching up, from being a third world country. So when a lot of the damage was happening in the U.S., projects were coming to a halt. There's still a lot moving forward, a lot of construction projects. And, I don't know if you've been to Mexico City, but, 10 years ago, it looked completely different than the city you see now. Buildings are all over the place. The infrastructure is much better. So all these projects were going forward during those times where some of those projects in the U.S. had come to a halt. So it was actually really good timing to be have a presence in both the U.S. and Mexico. And
I have this
that's
vision of you. I have this vision of you being down there, and it's like a scene out of Narcos where you're setting up the office and.
Early days, it was something like that, but nowadays it's much more refined, and it's very similar to other major cities in the world.
What led to your move to Abu Dhabi?
So something very similar. We had a need to be in the Middle East, specifically in Abu Dhabi, but also very similar the contract staffing or recruitment market. Very different in the Middle East, and sometimes can be illegal if not done the right way. So I think we wanted to try to make one last ditch effort and see if we can make it work and make contract recruitment work in that market. So something very similar to Mexico City, a lot of research, a lot of investment in time, and just making sure that we felt good about the model. And then once we were able to do that, we actually saw that we had quite a bit to offer the region. So we went in to kind of fulfill one need. It turned into be quite a nice product to multiple clients outside of our initial need, and it was a great market at the time. And even though Dubai had already gone through its boom, there was quite a big amount of projects going off, especially on the rail side and other construction projects on the infrastructure side. And we just really got there at the right time with a really good model. And then we did really well. We were pretty much all throughout the region doing business, and it's like once again still there today and doing well. And I think with the Middle East, if you can get it right and you're there for the long run, then I think you'll benefit from it. But if you're trying to catch the curve or you're trying to catch the uptick, a lot of people have been burned on Dubai, and as we all know, or they've maybe gotten there right when it starts to come down, and when it comes down pretty hard.
These boom and bust markets, as I've learned to my own detriment, they're risky, eh? So what was your personal life like when you were like in Mexico compared to Abu Dhabi? Like, could you find two more different places on earth?
As far as a personal life, I think with Mexico City in the early days, it was you had to worry about safety. You also had to worry about professional safety as far as you had potential fraudulent activities going on in the business market. You also had to kind of make sure that your employees were safe. So that was just as much part of the process as make sure their skill set was a fit. Whereas in the Middle East, it was more about most of our product or our clients were looking for expat individuals coming across. So we almost became more of a visa service company to get people in country on time and staying long enough to complete the project. So both had completely different requirements in order for us to see a success in the market. But it was all about the beginning stages of understanding what it really was that that client needed for us to see a success. So if I think if we would have went in with the mindset of, we're just going to find you good candidates for your project, I think we would probably have failed because we would have missed the mark on what the client really needed.
So you went back to the US then, and then the world ended in oil and gas in 2015.
Yeah, I would say the U.S. Is an interesting one. It's still the most robust market in the world. And when oil and gas is down, usually you'll see other projects at its peak. So, you know, IT technology side of the business has been an absolute gangbuster since, right around that time anyways. But also other things have taken off. You know, you look at the healthcare market, it's just an absolute booming industry. Construction industry is taking off in areas, and it's just one of those things where if all of your eggs are in that one basket, and if it's not a diverse enough basket, then you probably are going to end up in a failure situation, or you're going to have to downsize and wait it out. I've just been lucky enough to be always in a diverse situation where we could just move resources to a more complex market and hang out. And then be successful there. And then once oil and gas is coming back, we're already there. We don't have to reopen shop and so forth. Mm. And I think that's really how you make it through these boom and bust markets.
What's your current remit with Gattaca?
So I run their Americas region. So Gattaca, which is formerly known as MatchTech, which is one of the largest engineering firms, they acquired NetWorkers. And when they did, they had quite a bit of an international footprint. So my experience aligned perfectly for them at the moment because it was ability for them to get someone who had international experience, understood the UK market, had worked for a UK company before. So that wasn't going to be an unfamiliar situation, but also my experience with the region of Latin America, US and Canada. So they really, I think there was a trust there right away that they had hired the right person to kind of do something with what they had acquired, and we've done quite well. You know, I would say we've grown quite quicker than they originally had hoped for, and you know, we're double digit growth each year on year. We've opened new offices quickly, and we'll see what the next couple of years has in store for us.
So I suppose I've never worked at a high level at a large company, so a lot of this. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are at a similar standpoint. So what was it like when you went into Gattaca? Like what is the first thing a group president should do to get things moving in the right direction?
I think it's all similarly or the same. I think, you know, you have to really understand what you have before you figure out what you're going to go and get. And I think that's a mistake sometimes people roles make. They've been successful somewhere else before, and they just figure it's a plug and play type scenario, and it's just never really that's the case. So I think for me it was understanding not only what the company could offer globally, but you know, what did we acquire, who were in the right seats, did we have the right seats, were we in the right locations, how was the process, was our structure appropriate, how was our compensation levels, how do we stand up to the market? You know, are we a specialist? Are we a generalist? We just really need to figure all that stuff out before we move forward. So we took, I would say, 4 months and really dug into all of that. And once we figured out exactly who we wanted to be and what we had, we had something really nice. You know, we offered a specialist product to areas that were being bombarded by generalists. And we really found our niche, and we grew quite rapidly once we put a sales process in place. Establish a sales culture, and we've just been off to the races since then. You know, we don't have every client. We don't have all the business, not even close, but the clients that we do have and the business that we do have, it really means a lot to both the client and us, and we're building something off of it. So it's worked out quite nicely.
What's the most challenging part of your job?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. You know, when you have, multiple locations, multiple cultures, a lot of expectations, different expectations for different areas. Plus you've got, you know, the corporate company, you know, the corporate company is quite a big company. Whereas we're more of a, in my region, we're more of a in startup mode. So you've got two kind of separate marching orders. You just have to make sure it works for everyone. Not, you're never going to please everyone, but I think as long as you have very clear and defined purpose in each of your locations, you've established your culture and you stick to that culture, and then you've got that proper sales presence, I think you'll do well. It's just knowing what that is first before you go out and try to sell it.
Is it just contract you guys do?
Oh, no, we do quite a bit of perm, being on the specialist side of the business. You know, I would say we're 50-50 perm and contract.
Okay. And with that, when you're looking at recruiters now compared to years ago, you touched on this at the start of the interview. How do you manage to get people to use the phone? Is that something that you're trying to overcome as a business, like a lot of other leaders out there?
Yeah, that dinosaur archaic technology that sits on people's desk called the phone is an interesting one. I think I went through my phase too, where I was constantly battling trying to get people to understand the way I did, and I was successful in the business. And I think sometimes we get trapped in that mode to where it's you will learn the way I did or else. And sometimes you may head down the wrong path doing that. So what we've tried to do is we've tried to break it down to what is it exactly that's going to make someone successful. So it could be as simple as, you know, your CV in front of a client and being able to close that deal. Okay, well, how do we get to that point? Is it only by phone or is it by face to face? Is it a coffee? Is it a LinkedIn send out? There's so many ways to do it. But if you're not doing those activities to get to that point of that CV in front of a client and that client to buy your candidate, then you're not going to be successful. So I think what we've tried to do is inform the newcomers about how useful a phone can be and what the benefits could be. But we've also tried to be open-minded enough to where, why are we shutting out technology? Could you not use both? I think we've done a good job, but listen, I'm always learning each day because I'm not the most technically savvy person, but it's amazing on what you can get done these days without picking up the phone. So we try to use both, and we try to take advantage of both.
Yeah, makes sense. And would you have any advice for any UK recruiters who move over to Houston? Have you seen any people that have done it really well? Have you seen it not work in your time? You must be aware that there's so many British recruiters coming and going from the Houston market.
Absolutely. We've even experienced that internally within our own company. And I think what happens is when you live in an outside market, especially the UK, and most of your work is done over the phone or via LinkedIn or something. And I think you almost feel that if you've been successful doing it that way, that it's almost a guarantee when you get into Houston, you're sitting in the market, that you should only see success. And I think what you sometimes overlook is the power of that connection is it can work magic for you. So if you're not used to making those connections, you're not used to getting out in front of the client or putting yourself out there, making those cold calls or making those introductions so that you actually build a robust pipeline of business, then what happens is that one contact you had or that one account that you had been working with, when that dries up, you don't know how to actually properly build a business. And so you're kind of stuck in a foreign land. You're different than the local culture. Your accent's different. Sometimes you just get into a situation where you just don't have the tools to actually properly build a business from start. So my advice would be, while you're making the transition or making the decision to come into the market, take the time to also learn the importance of actually building a business from scratch, and get yourself with, if you're lucky enough to have, if you're in a UK company and they have a local presence, you know, I would start working with them early, learning how they make cold calls, learning how they go on to meetings, learning how they connect with that local person that may not be familiar with, the British business or wherever else you're calling from, so that when you get into the market, hopefully you've got established business. But even if you don't, that you can kind of find your way into that, and being a local success, because it could be a benefit to you that if you have an international presence, but you also have local knowledge, then you become a powerful individual in the market.
Matt Evelt, that's us today. Thank you so much.
It's been fantastic. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, man, you were fantastic yourself. Take care.
All right, take care.
Well, a massive thank you to Matt for coming on the podcast. Incredible journey that he's had, taking him all over the world. Interesting to get the perspective of a US senior exec working for a UK company, and just to get his version on that. Now, something interesting there is he was suggesting that the American market requires you to be more relationship driven than transactional. And I think a lot of Americans view British recruitment firms as quite transactional, which, you know, can be a fair enough comment in the S3 mold and companies that have come out of that. And, you know, that works for certain companies, and that's fine. What I have found is it's hard to lump America into one bracket. I would probably lump Texas into the same bracket as Calgary and Western Australia and probably the Middle East, where they're oil and gas hubs, where there's it's real embedded community of business leaders. And it's a bit old school in that you have to get in front of them. You have to do a bit of a handshake, have a cigar, glass of whiskey. No, I'm only joking about that. But you definitely have to press the flesh. And in those regional oil and gas hubs, I think that's really important. But that's what's fascinating about recruitment. It's different in every region that you work around the world and every sector. And there's no right way. There's no wrong way. There's just different ways. And hopefully through this podcast, we're getting to listen to people who've got the experience to tell us what's what. So again, massive thank you to Matt. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate it and all the feedback that we've been getting. Our downloads are almost doubling every week, which, yeah, it's pretty amazing. So grateful for all the support that we're getting. And we'll be back tomorrow with another fantastic guest.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.